Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to welcome Brighton Wishart from Cured Compliance to the show. Welcome, Brighton.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
So this is a fun one for us because I feel like we can sometimes be a little bit insular talking to people who are working directly on Django, but you live in Australia and you're building this real-world solution with Django. So I'm excited to talk about what that is and how you've done it. So maybe could you give the quick pitch on what is Cured Compliance?
Yeah, I definitely. So Cured Compliance was a bit of a brainchild between myself and my business partner who just happened to be a butcher. But what we've looked to do, I guess, is digitize all the compliance and regulation that a retail butcher in Australia has to do. So, you know, people don't realize the amount of, I guess, regulation that goes into making meat safe and, you know, ensuring the meat that a butcher is selling to us consumers is safe and, you know, fit
well,
for
not,
human
not
consumption.
In the US. We just had a big Boar's Head scandal where it sounds like they just did whatever they wanted for a long time.
Yeah, and look, Australia originally actually had something very similar back in the 90s that kicked off regulation. We seem to like regulation in Australia.
Can I just butt in? Because like one of the supposed advantages of Brexit was that we'd be able to import US meat. And then like, but hang on, US meat, the standards aren't quite what we were used to. And so there was a bit of like, is that, I don't know. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's the standards. It's the, you know, at least in the United States, there's this, the FDA, Federal Food and Drug Administration, and they noted that there were problems, but as often as the case, they're severely underfunded. Yeah, anyways, we don't need to get into that. But yes, it's good that especially food that we consume has regulation, and so there's quite a lot of it in Australia.
Yeah, and we just happened, I guess, to come across a gap where everything was paper-based. So it was kind of this opportunity to really innovate the industry, right, which was awesome.
Give us a sense of the timing, because you've been up for a while, but when did you first start trying to, you know, attack this with a web solution?
Yeah, so as a business, this is sort of our third year of operation. So we're still a fairly young startup, but I maybe started this 6 months before we incorporated. So it's sort of been about a 3-6 month journey, and that's realistically where I sort of found Django. So that was kind of my first time I touched Django as a framework, was sort of that 3-6 months ago, just kind of when we had this idea.
So can I ask, you were assessing two or three options that are out there. What stuck out about Django? How come you sort of, you know, because you'd be taking a bit of a punt if you didn't know it previously.
Yeah, I guess for me, it was kind of, I looked through a whole lot of things. I sort of had a fundamental knowledge of Python from the early days. And this was back sort of when the machine learning kicked off with the introduction of the cloud computing. So I'd sort of done a bit of work with Python there and went, that's kind of the language I know and trust. And then just went hunting for frameworks. And for me, it was all about, I didn't want to do the difficult things like manage authentication, manage all of those sort of things, I guess, that, you know, we say is batteries included, that some of the other frameworks just didn't have. Because, yeah, you don't want to get authentication wrong.
Yeah, right. So that batteries included thing, that's a real big selling point, right?
Huge for me.
So then maybe walk us through, like, where did you start? What was the, you know, start project and then what?
Yeah, I guess it was kind of a start project and start just diving into building or taking some of these paper forms and just digitizing them. And that was kind of the start. And originally when this started, it wasn't so much we wanted to make a product to sell. This was, how do I solve a problem for my mate's business, more or less, right? How do we
perfect
digitize this and make it simple? And so there was kind of no plan to productize this or commercialize it in any way, shape, or form. It was purely, let's build something. Nothing, you know, we did the first bit of research, which was, does something exist in the market that we could just buy and use and solve the problem? And there was kind of nothing designed for the meat industry. Everything was very much a, hey, you're a cafe. These are kind of your pre-start checklist, and that's kind of it, right? So there's a bit more involved, especially when you're doing like small goods production, that sort of stuff in the media industry, you've got to have that traceability layer. Yeah. And so there was sort of nothing out there, and we decided to do the idiotic thing and build it ourselves.
Well, there's nothing like ignorance, right?
Definitely nothing like ignorance.
I was going to ask, so did you go form first? Because often people start with the models and then they build a view and then the form comes last. But because you're starting from these paper forms, is it almost the other way?
Yeah, it was kind of start with the forms and then, you know, very quickly learnt about the ORM and how that operated and what models were and that sort of part. Because, you know, previously my programming knowledge was very much Visual Basics back, I want to say 15 years ago. And, you know, you'd write a SQL code to deploy to a database and that was it. So this whole model and ORM was a very foreign concept to me as a developer. Like, it wasn't something I'd touched before. So
yeah.
Very quickly learned that the ORM and models were my best friend and it meant I didn't have to write SQL, which was amazing. And then it was kind of this build the form, build the model and start to really think about what do models need to look like to digitize? Because there was a bit of a learning curve going from here's a paper form that sort of has, here's all the information they want to capture, but how should this best be designed into a model that's allow that whole class-based driven, you know, automatic form and all that sort of stuff.
And I'm assuming there's a little bit of back and forth, like a full start, like, oh, you create a model, oh, that's not structured right. And
totally. I got very, very comfortable with working with migrations and rolling migrations back and doing all that sort of stuff really quickly because, yeah, you do make mistakes in those models and you go, that's just not going to work, especially if you start thinking about how does it scale, right? So originally when it was just sort of this one thing for one person, it was like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
But then kind of as another person went, hey, I'd like this too, we went, oh, okay, how do we make this better, I guess, from a design point of view?
I guess as well, you didn't filter by user account first time out. So like, you know, because it's just for your mate, you don't need to restrict the query sets.
Yep. Yeah, correct. And, you know, I think originally I was using just a default user profile. And then I hit that part where we're kind of up and running with our first customer. I went, oh, I'm really limited to what I can do with this user profile from day dot. And so I had to go and do the extended custom user model to add those additional attributes, right? Which then meant restarting the entire project, restarting the migrations. And lucky enough at that point in time, there wasn't really any data in the system and the other customer hadn't been using it for that long that they were like, yeah, that's fine. Blow it away, start again.
Yeah. Okay.
So I sort of learned that the hard way, which was fun.
But it's a good thing to learn that lesson at that point rather than sort of much later on when you...
Yep. definitely.
I'm just curious, what came next, right? At what point, so the models alone is a huge thing. At what point were you working on the interface that the, you know, the butchers could use? Like, how long did that take?
Yeah, that's being kind of an evolution. And I'm not a CSS guy, so I'm lucky enough that I know someone who's very, very good at that user experience and is really good at CSS. So we ended up just contracting him in to do sort of one day of work a week on just helping making the user interface. We chose Bootstrap as a simple framework to work with from that UI experience because people are very used to that look and feel. And then it was kind of, how do we simulate the paper? Like, how do we make the form, the digital form, look like the paper form? Because butchers are kind of in that digital divide where, because of COVID, a lot of shop prices went up. But before COVID, big supermarkets have sort of driven down the prices. So you sort of have this generational gap of butchers in Australia. And so it was kind of that, how do we make this digital experience as closest to the paper experience for them. So they weren't sitting there going, what does this additional field mean? How does it flow? And then it's kind of that, yeah, we just started there and that was kind of the starting point. And it's sort of evolved over time as we've optimized forms, I guess, where you're not double handling information or where passing data through between different forms, etc.
Okay. And can I ask that for the layouts? Because I guess if you want to match a paper layout, did you use something like Crispy Forms or...
Yeah, was using Crispy forms and then using the layout functions in the forms so I could just define those all as Python functions, which, or I guess dictionaries they are, to make it really simple from that sort of UI. Because again, I don't want to bloat my HTML up. It's like, let the framework do the heavy lifting to a degree, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, as much as you can, right?
Yep.
Well, it sounds like the butchers really hated the paperwork, because getting people to switch, even if they have some annoyance, is, you know, famously hard, right? It has to be really overbearing to have someone, you know, take time out of being busy to learn a new system. But I guess that sort of proves the efficacy of what you're trying to do if at least one or two people were willing to go down that journey.
Yeah, and I think we also approached the regulators and went through their experience to make sure it was going to suit their requirements as well, right? Because, you know, I guess as an application in a regulated industry, your app is only effective if the regulator actually supports it.
Yeah.
So we built something, the regulator went, nah, that's not right. We'd be dead in the water.
Do you have to print things out for the regulator, or how do you submit compliance to them, right? If they're used to accepting forms, paper forms.
Yeah. So they actually have a physical audit. So an auditor will come out on site to the shop, and that's kind of where they would view all those forms and tick that off. So we've sort of done those training sessions with their auditors to go, hey, this is how you can see this type of information. And they've actually really adopted, I guess, really loved it, because for them, it's not looking through two or three binders of forms. It's cool. I just want to look at this information, quick and easy. Here's a filter, bang, done. So it sort of streamlined some of their auditing processes, which has helped a lot as well.
I can imagine as well that they might sort of pre-do some of the paperwork, well, the what was paperwork. They can do it in the office before they go to the shop. And then when they get to the shop, you know, they can spend more time actually inspecting rather than looking at the paperwork, which is possibly a win.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things we're sort of looking to roll out with, I guess, regulators in the long term is that whole digital audit experience. So it can be, hey, I'm just going to rock up and walk through your shop now to make sure it's clean. But everything else is done.
Okay, sounds good.
And then you have, I mean, there's so much in here. You have some Internet of Things around temperature, and like walk us through like what are all the things, and then how do you, you know, sync that up with the dashboard?
Yeah, so my business partner had this wonderful idea that he wanted to monitor his fridges and freezers, which originally I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Let me go and see if there's something we can buy off the shelf, right? Which, you know, the great thing is there's a lot of sensors that do that job for us. But then I was kind of like, how do I actually plug this into the Django, right? How do I get the data there? How do I store the data efficiently, and how do I, you know, create the interfaces that you can view and see the data? Because having the data is one thing, but if you can't view it, it's worthless, right? And so we sort of started with this. We found a vendor that sold these really, really just basic Bluetooth gateways. And we went down the road of Bluetooth sensors using just Bluetooth low energy sensors. The idea being they were cheap. If a butcher broke them, it wasn't going to break the bank to replace them, because butcher's apprentices are known to just wash everything with a hose, and including electronics. So having those sort of cheap replaceable sensors was kind of the idea was, hey, if you break one, it's not the end of the world. You're not paying $500. It's a, you know, $30 sensor. Just buy another one. And then we had these gateways, and originally these gateways were just doing post requests to an endpoint that I wrote, which then sort of raised me as, well, how do I secure this endpoint, right? Because these gateways don't do authentication. So I actually had to then write some middleware that worked more or less like a whitelist. So it would look up the customer's environment, go, does his MAC address as a gateway be registered in their environment? If so, that's an acceptable post request and accept it. If not, just drop it pretty much at the server level.
I need to ask you so about your previous experience, because to just think of and implement middleware is a fairly advanced thing. So had you done, like, how did you know about this concept of middleware and to take that approach for this problem?
Lots and lots of reading. So I've got both of your books, Will, from memory, and I'm one of those people, once I read a book...
Well, it's not in there. Customizing middleware is not in there, though.
Right, but it sort of, it gave me enough to go, there's got to be a way, like, there's that whole middleware piece. There's got to be something that I can do. And that's kind of where I just started digging deeper and reading the docs, to be honest, as like, hey, how does middleware work? And then you just start doing the old Google search for tutorials on middleware. Yep. And that's kind
it's pretty,
of where,
pretty thin, yeah. I think, though.
found enough to get something functional.
I want to ask about this because hang on a sec. You're now storing quite soon off the bat. You're now storing time series data from instruments, which like that just must stack up really, really, really quickly.
It does. And lucky enough, I only take one measurement every 5 minutes.
Okay.
So right. it's not every second. Every second would be a different game. But, you know, Postgres is very, very good at doing this type of stuff. And it's kind of one of those things, the old, I guess, developer problem is, do you over-optimize?
Yeah.
And start thinking about that, or you go, do we wait until we have a problem? And then go, cool, hopefully by then I've got a bit more money that I could throw at the problem and get it resolved that way.
Yeah, if you've got traffic without any
so
money.
So that's kind of where I'm at with the point. Yeah.
are you reaching scaling limits now?
Yeah, nowhere near scaling limits yet. We are just slow and steady growing as a business, which is wonderful. I'm sort of, you know, this is still myself and my business partner and our one contractor.
Perfect.
So we are still a very small startup, and there is a physical limit of how many customers you can onboard because of that. Which is, you know, I think a blessing in disguise, because it means I'm not dealing with hyperscale. And hyperscale is scary.
It gives you time to grow, right? And it gives you time to grow into the bigger things. And oh no, we can tweak the database. Relax a bit. Tweak the server. Okay, relax a bit.
I want to ask about that endpoint, just because that's something that the three of us can just say, oh, just toss up an endpoint. But someone who's newer in their career, like, how exactly did you do that? Did you use Django REST framework? Did you use Django Ninja? Like, what, you know?
Yeah.
Since you said that the rest of the project is explicitly not really using APIs, you're using HTMX, so it's server rendered.
Yeah, I actually think I just modified, and I probably have to look at the code because it's been a while since I've looked at it. But I'm pretty sure.
That's good. That means it's just working.
It is literally a function view. One of the few function views I have written.
Okay.
And it then just either returns a HTTP response 200 and grabs the JSON data and loads that through. So it's, not using REST, not using anything like that. It's just a boring old function view.
I mean, if it works, it works.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, you're making me think that maybe that's an interesting angle to, you know, teach people about API stuff rather than just jumping right to REST framework or some of these things. Be like, well, we can do it a little more simply. That's interesting. Anyways, not to get off topic, but
if I'm a butcher and I've got data on my fridge because I need to show to the inspectors that my fridge is a. What happens if, say, the power goes out and, you know, can I get a warning about that or?
Yeah, so that sort of became the next step. Is once we had this data, the challenge was like, well, how do we put alerting around it?
Right.
So
okay.
how do you manage that? How do we approach that? And that sort of brought in, I guess, if you consider sort of the lifespan of the app, we started with a real basic web app that, you know, was designed for one person, realistically. And then also another person went, I want that as well, and went, oh, now we have multi-tenancy. How do we approach that? How do we go down that road? And so, you know, the great thing is we have a really good, rich environment, I guess, in Django of all these third-party add-ons that it's very easy to get this sort of functionality without doing a lot of engineering. And then the alerting brought on that whole, well, now I need some form of task processor because, you know, you can't just do that, I guess, off a... I'm sure there's a way you could do it, but it's probably not the efficient way or the right way to do it, right? You probably need some sort of background processor running to do this alerting or alarming, or have the hardware do it for you. And obviously the hardware could alert you. But at that point, we just didn't have the hardware that had that functionality.
Right, okay. All it can do is take a measurement and send it somewhere.
Yep. So we ended up looking at Django Q, and that was kind of the one that I went, that's simple to deploy. It really just needed a Redis service to to act as its queuing mechanism. And I spent a lot of time with Celery, but I just found its learning curve to be too great at that point in time, right? Django queue, sort of everything was built into Django admin. So you could just log in and go, let me create a scheduled task, and off it went.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly it. Celery is super powerful, but super hard to stand up even. And, you know, if you just want a queue, it's not necessarily the first port of call.
I think in our notes here, you're using Django tenants. And then did you add Django queue functionality there, or can you talk us through that?
Yeah, so I found a really old, there was a package for Django queue tenants, but it wasn't maintained at all. And so I ended up jumping in and I guess having to do some comparisons between what were they doing in this Django queue tenants, multi-tenant framework package that Django queue was doing. And so I ended up having to spend a lot of time there to rewrite that to be supported just in time for, I think, Stan to release Django queue 2. Because Django queue as itself was also, I guess, a stale package and wasn't getting any sort of lover updates. So I then had to rewrite this, I guess, package to then support Django queue as well and sort of go through those changes that Stan made as well.
So this is the great baptism of fire, where you realize that your business is built upon a package which needs a maintainer, and you therefore welcome to package maintainer.
Yep. Pretty much that old, trying to think of the comic where it's just, here's this one package that supports the entire web. That's exactly what it felt like. I was like, yep, okay, I've got to do something here to keep it functional and keep it up to date.
So multi-tenancy, I wanted to ask just what caused you to think I need to adopt Django tenants? Because you could arguably maybe do it without that, right? You could just have multiple users and they have access. Like, how did you think about that process and decide to, you know, add a little more complexity, but clearly you felt it was worth it?
Yeah, I sort of looked at, I guess, the three different ways you can do multi-tenancy, right? And, you know, the first way is you just have some sort of flag in every single model that relates that this row belongs to this tenant. You could go down the road of having a database for every single customer, which, you know, is probably the most secure way, but probably the least cost-effective way. And ultimately, it was the schema separation and just that inbuilt into Django tenants that kind of went, this is probably the easiest way for me to do it without having to rebuild every single model with a tenant field, more or less.
Yeah, I asked partly because I'm aware of multi-tenancy, but I haven't personally had the need to build out anything with Django tenants. And so, but yet it's one of the questions I'm asked a lot by readers is, you know, do you have support for multi-tenancy? And so trying to wrap my head around what exactly are they asking there? Are they just read about it, or do they, you know, I thought you gave a nice summation there of it.
Yeah. And I think the other selling point for me was I wanted it to be a, I guess, domain separation for customers. So every customer has their own, you know, business name at curedcompliance.com. So it creates a bit of ownership, opposed to maybe using something like a header approach where they just log into a single website and it's, you know, the header handles sort of the tenancy aspect on the back end. So I think that creates a bit of a customer ownership piece, but it also opens up the ability in the future to do their own sort of CNAME branding as well, right? So if they have their own domain, they could create their own curedtheirdomain.com type approach as well, and we could support that from a DNS point of view.
And you said, you know, Django's got this nice ecosystem of third-party packages, and it's really easy to pick one up. But each one you pick up, there's a learning curve to it, right? It's like, oh, I've got to allocate this week to learn Django tenants, or you know, this week to learn the queues, or this week to learn.
Yeah, so that probably comes just from my background of I started life as a teacher. So this whole motion of lifelong learning, and I've come to be really addicted to that horrible learning curve where it's like, hey, I start to understand stuff. And then you go, oh, I actually know very little now. You sort of go start to build mastery after that, right? So I tend to love that drop where you realization, you go, oh, no, I have no idea what I'm doing here. But you start to build and develop those skills.
Yeah, you thought that was the deep bit. No. That's good. Just while we're on this last bit, so are you now helping to maintain Django Q2, or are you in sort of around the ecosystem there, just keeping your eye on it?
Look, definitely around helping where possible. I think Stan's helped me out with a couple of sort of things I've had wrong on my end when I did the switch. But I am sort of, I guess, maintaining the Django Q2 tenants piece at the moment. I haven't packaged it up, but there is, I think, a link on Stan's GitHub to it for anyone who does want to use it. So you can just fork my version and be up and running more or less. So yeah, I am a little bit involved there. One day I hope to be involved a lot more, but I'm still a learner in that sense.
No, that's cool. Take it slowly, because you can't ever offload these things once you take them on, right?
Well, I want to ask about deploying, because I know you're in the Windows ecosystem, but is there anything else around just the Django bit itself that, you know, you want to highlight or we should have asked you about?
Look, I think we can go and talk about deployment, and I'm sure we'll come back at some point.
Okay, so, you know, why Microsoft? Why Windows ecosystem? Right, you were telling us a little bit about this offline, but most of the mindshare is probably around maybe not Windows for a startup situation.
Yeah, as an organization, we applied for the Founders Hub from Microsoft, and that sort of just gave us a whole lot of Azure credits. And having just, I guess, my technical background as an IT pro, being really deep in the Azure world and the Microsoft world, for me, it was kind of the simplest learning curve to go, cool, let's get deployment going. You know, I had done sort of previous work where I'd help customers deploy, you know, Azure web apps with databases in that sort of PaaS environment world. So for me, it was kind of, you know, that DevOpsy piece was actually the easiest part of the whole process. It was the learning to be a developer was the hard part.
So not the ops, the dev. But use what you know, right? That's because people are like, what should I deploy? And it's like, well, do you know anything? I know this. Well, use that, like, absolutely every time.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I think AWS and Azure, you know, they've done some really good stuff with like startups where you can apply and, you know, you pretty much get a lot of value of money. I think my hosting's been covered for about 3 years so far.
Okay. And that's not bad,
is
it?
Huge. As a business, it's a huge, you know, leg up, right?
Yeah, free development, or free, you know, free that bit.
So I think you have some notes here about where you want to go, right? There's something about MicroPython and ambient temperature. Like, talk to us about what's on your wish list where you want the product to go.
I guess once we transition to sort of version 2 of hardware, and version 2 was based on an MQTT gateway. So we've transitioned away from that post request type. Process. I've still got a few customers on that older hardware, but we transitioned to, I guess, to a more robust messaging protocol. And that was really around, we found some hardware that we could build up functionality and capability in the portal to actually program the hardware. So it allows a customer to go into the portal, go, hey, I want to, you know, change something on this sensor, and that's going to push down through the MQTT gateway and program that sensor to that point. Now, we've still kept that sort of Bluetooth approach in terms of sensor tech, but that MQTT sort of approach has just opened up a whole lot of functionality. And that's then started to get me thinking about, well, we've been trying to solve this one problem, and that is when a butcher does a cooking, so let's say they're cooking ham or bacon, at the moment they use a data logger. That data logger goes in the meat, measures that. That's normally a USB type device. They then have to plug that into a computer, download the Excel spreadsheet, and we wanted to create, I guess, an experience where a butcher could just put in our hardware, go into the cooking log, and just hit the start recording button, and straight away you have that cooking log being put straight against the actual log with, you know, pretty graphs showing cooking temperatures, all that sort of stuff, as you know, as it flows.
Yeah, and anytime you've got rid of an Excel spreadsheet, that's a win, right? That's
totally. And so that sort of, we tried to find, I guess, hardware that suited that requirement, and we couldn't find anything. So I, again, did the old Google around, hey, what could I use, you know, what could I use in Python to help me build sort of, I guess, that next layer down of hardware? And MicroPython was kind of this great package, or I guess, framework, again, that has quite a lot of functionality that I could actually start working with. And I think I ordered in a couple of ESP32s, and plugged them in and just started plugging away to sort of build this stuff. And, you know, I ordered in some decent thermometers that, you know, RTD units that sort of had the requirements and, you know, again, pulled out my old physics textbook on electrical engineering and started going rereading, you know, things like Ohm's law and going, that's right, you know, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, just started sort of working on some circuitry stuff and, you know, reading different parts. And so we ended up to the point where we've got a prototype unit that works there. But just the capital expense right now to take it to the next level is sort of, you know, 15-20K.
Yeah, right.
Which, you know, as a, again, you know, a small startup, it's, you've got to look at it and go, do I spend that sort of investment on such a single piece of hardware, or is there money better spent on other aspects right now to, you know, help growth and whatnot?
Sure, but that's pretty cool. But I can imagine it's also a bit of a rabbit hole that you can be like, oh, I could be fixing this UI bug that I don't really, or I could be playing with my microcontrollers. That's a bit of a risk, huh?
Yep, totally. And it's that whole, you know, how thin do you spread yourself across something, right? And yeah, there's a reason it kind of got to a point. And it's like, yep, there's a prototype. I could give that to somebody else to manufacture and they could, you know, improve it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess you contract that out. Once you get to a certain point, you can contract that out to companies in China, right, who will put it together and all the rest.
Yeah, even a local company just to, I guess, finalize design pieces and do the certification. Because again, depending on what hardware you put on it, you've got to go through, you know, wireless certifications, battery certifications. You know, once you've done all that, then you go, you know, go to a manufacturer in China and go, I want 1,000 units of these and, you know, give me your best price pretty much. But it's kind of that, you've got to do that certification step first.
Right, okay. So it's not trivial.
Patent it and then sell to one of the larger chains that would have use of it and they could handle it?
Look, I could patent it. I don't think it's patentable to a degree because it is just a thermometer, and the reason we're rebuilding it is we just weren't happy with the accuracy from a compliance point of view. And that's because there's kind of a range we've got to work, which is negative 30 to about 120 degrees, and we need to be within 0.5 degree accuracy in that range. Most otherwise won't be accepted by the regulator. Most thermometers that they're using at the moment actually don't meet those standards. But we don't want to be that company building something that doesn't meet that standard, especially when, you know, the strong point of our company is we are backed by the regulators to a degree where they've gone, yep, we're happy for this to be used and we trust them to deliver XYZ for us.
Yeah, and that badge on the website, that's got to mean everything, right?
Yep.
You have paying customers now, right? It's moved beyond your business partner.
Yeah, that's correct. I think my last count was about 50 butchers across Australia paying a monthly subscription. So, you know, we sort of pick up about two or three every fortnight. So one a week.
Wow.
On a growth. That's, and it's just
that's a nice,
nice, slow and consistent, which is what I like.
So a couple questions around that. The first is, so what are you using for subscriptions? How are you managing that?
Yeah, so Stripe is really, really good at that stuff.
Okay.
And again, you know, there's a wonderful package for Stripe that makes it very, very easy to manage Stripe.
Oh, the DJ Stripe?
Not DJ Stripe. I think it's just a Stripe Python package. Just the Stripe package.
Oh, yes. Yeah, their own Python package. Yeah.
Yeah, just built out the subscription sort of service to do that. And the one challenge we actually had there was the way the webhook works from Stripe and the way, I guess, because every request we have comes from a customer's tenant that comes from its own CNAMED URL, the Stripe endpoint, you know, I'd have to have a webhook for every single endpoint. So I actually wrote a very tiny Azure Function app in Python that just sits there as a middleware more or less and collects their web endpoints, and then based upon the metadata in the endpoint, then redirects it to the correct tenant for ingestion to update the subscription.
The middleware is for everything.
It's again, you just find ways to solve problems, right?
That's interesting. I'm working on a sort of e-commerce course, and subscriptions is a big thing that sort of can be simple to do in prototype, but then often has a little bit more complexity than people think. And also then you have to dive into user accounts and how do you, you know, manage it? Do you have a flag? How much are you tracking churn? So it can quickly become a rabbit hole in practice. I am discovering, but sounds like it wasn't much of an issue for you. You just Python package from Stripe and yeah, write a couple of middleware and you're good.
Yeah, it got it functional right. And again, it's I could definitely improve it, but if it's working right now and it's not a security risk, I'm kind of looking at the technical debt going, do I need to pay it right now?
Right. So there's the question, right? You've got a business, you're up and running, you're 3 years in. Okay. So this is a good place to be because now, but now you've got this sort of, okay, how do I spend my time? Am I building new features? Am I paying down some of that technical debt, cleaning up some of those gnarly bits that have been there since week two? And how do you balance that kind of consideration need?
I think the balance is you've just got to be paying back technical debt on a weekly basis. Not much, but if you pay back a little bit every single week, you never get into that really, really bad situation where it's like, oh, I can't upgrade because of something. And I guess I've been in a couple of companies where they never paid technical debt and I've kind of seen that hell. And it's like, okay, you know, it's only going to be a couple hours every week, but that's enough to sort of keep you there. So, you can do those really simple upgrades between the different versions of Django, package updates, and not have everything fall over.
Okay. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I would try and put aside a Friday morning. It's like, okay, a couple of hours on a Friday morning to just, you know, clean the floor.
I guess the fact that it's just you, like you are working on the new features and you are feeling the technical debt. Like from my experience, one of the problems with technical debt is the people deciding on what to do next are a layer up or up. And so they're not feeling that pain. So to them, it's an abstract thing. But when you're on the ground floor fighting with it, it builds up and takes an emotional and time toll on you.
Yeah, it's definitely much easier, I guess, being on the tools to make those decisions than, again, like I said, in some other companies I've been in where, yeah, it is that layer removed. Unless you've got a really, really, really good technical person putting together really good documentation going, this is why, you know, they're always going to go to what is the most cost optimized approach to something, which isn't always the right decision.
Or also though, it can often be that like the marketing side or the business side have sold something or they're wanting to sell something and the push is to get that done. It's like, no, all this other stuff you technical people are talking about doesn't matter. Get this done. And it's like, but hang on, you realize you're killing us slowly, right? With this constant grind.
Definitely. Death by a thousand cuts.
So it's amazing hearing all the things you've built and honestly your attitude about all this of like, oh, I'll just do this and that. Like it doesn't seem like you've hit major stumbling blocks with Django specifically. Is that fair to say so far?
Definitely. It's been a wonderful framework to work with. Compared to some of the other people I've spoken to who I guess are using more of those Java or Node type frameworks. It's nice that it works. That's a really nice benefit, right?
It's nice that it works. We should get some t-shirts with that.
Yeah. We're at that point of the show. So magic wand, what would you like Django to add, right? Because this is obviously, Carlton and I came from DjangoCon a couple of weeks ago, and this is always the discussion internally. Like, are there some things that are top of mind, you know, if Django only had, it would make things easier for you?
Yeah, I guess this maybe comes from my security background, but I think inbuilt multi-factor is kind of just a crucial thing that it needs to be in an app these days. Like I can't, if you look at all the security frameworks, you know, the default requirement now is that any web internet facing application you're using has or supports multi-factor. And I think that's something that probably needs to just be an inbuilt battery now, opposed to potentially a package.
And what are you using that now with your clients? And if yes, what are you using?
Yeah, I think I'm using one that's maintained by JazzBand and my mind's gone totally blank on its name.
It's two-factor auth is what it's called.
Yeah, two-factor auth. Yeah,
okay.
That's the one.
And are you using Django AllAuth at all or just regular Django with this?
Just regular Django with this.
Well, I think you listened to this show, like Carlton and I have been banging on about this, and they're actually, Carlton and I need to, separate from this, talk about there's some work that's being done around authentication, both the documents and I think the code. So maybe not as big as this, like right now, but I think most people would agree, like, yeah, we should have this or something like this in core.
Yeah, no, two-factor, like one-time passwords at least, like something. It doesn't have to be, you know, every possible option, but, you know, an out-the-box look to FA, that would be lovely. I guess with butchers, you don't have people saying they want single sign-on to their, you know, to their global provider or anything, but they, yeah. How do you guys, can I ask, butchers, that, like, traditionally not thought of as, like, the most technically sort of connected people, so how do you educate them about using two-factor auth and things like that? Do you point them towards a password manager or?
Look, I think in the industry, we've probably been really lucky, and it's been led by banks. If you consider every bank this day forces two-factor on pretty much all their consumers, most people get two-factor these days. You know, if you went back before COVID and maybe a few more years then, I definitely know my IT pro days, there was always a massive change project to get multi-factor or something rolled out. But I think banks have done an amazing job of just forcing it on everybody, and everybody's kind of accepted it as a security improvement. So the discussion doesn't get too hard to have about two-factor for butchers because they're kind of used to that already from their banks.
Right, okay. That helps. I think that Australia may be a little bit ahead of other places in that. What's on your roadmap then, Brighton? What's the next 12 months, 18 months, if you could knock off a few, you know, headline features, what are you excited to build?
Yeah, there's one feature that I've sort of been working on, and that is we want to do some machine learning. And this is not so much because of the AI boom, but more around there's just a really novel problem I want to solve. And that is at a regulation level, a butcher is meant to be monitoring the meat temperature. So that actually means the actual temperature of the meat, not just the refrigeration ambient temperature. And so what I want to work on is, can we have a probe unit sit in the meat for a day, have the ambient temperature and the probe temperature running side by side, and then based upon that, develop an algorithm that's unique for that fridge going, cool, if your fridge is saying this degrees, then your meat temperature is going to be this degrees. And depending on how long the meat sits in that fridge for or display cabinet, it will slowly warm up over a period of time. So being able to then predict this is what the meat temperature should be to provide that, I guess, that next level of assurance.
Yeah, okay. And then you could probably measure actual measurements periodically to check that that was still within bounds of...
You know. Correct. Yep. And, you know, you look from a pipeline, as soon as you have that fridge go outside of its ambient temperature parameters, you could then invalidate that machine learning model and go, because the fridge has changed this is no longer a valid thing, so you need to remeasure.
Yeah. And you've got to measure more frequently, or you've got, you know... Because, yeah, and all of that can be ticked off by the regulator again. And yeah, okay, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's just a really cool, novel machine learning problem, right? It's not building some crypto or something. It's like, here's a practical use of machine learning.
Well, it's regression, right? You're going to fit to a curve. Good.
One thing I haven't heard you mention, which I only know of because my brother-in-law worked at a startup that was doing digitizing inventory for, I think it was restaurants or food suppliers, but their issue is they wanted to have an iPad app to replace, you know, paper, but people would go into the freezer, and in the freezer, they would lose cell phone or they'd lose reception and they come back. So they had to do all these technical things around offline versus online. It sounds like that's not an issue for you at all. Like people are just entering it in on a computer, so you don't have to deal with that situation.
Yeah. It's not an issue as of yet, but we are, I guess, a reactive web app. So we do build down whether you're on a mobile phone, a tablet form factor, or a PC. So for us, a lot of these butchers, it's more just getting Wi-Fi signal in the shop. You know, they might have their little consumer router sitting in the office that's in a different location, but then all the work is happening quite a way through multiple brick walls and cold rooms are very, very good at blocking signals. And so we've sort of had to help. And that's kind of one of the things that our gateways also do is they act as an access point as well. So our new gateways, not only do they do the MQTT, but they're also an access point that can then relay internet connections via either an Ethernet or via Wi-Fi.
Right, I was about to say, are you running Ethernet into the fridges? Like, that's a bit geeky, but... That's what you're doing, right?
Yeah. So certain places we are, yeah, running Ethernet in and you plug into the gateway and off it goes. If not, you put the gateways next to each other close enough through the walls that they can talk wirelessly and they just act as a wireless bridge and off they go.
Okay, super. I'm really excited. Your business sounds brilliant.
Well, I have to admit, I'm pretty blown away. Just all that you've, you know, mainly you have done in this big, big problem. I guess I can't help but think of the business case. Like how many, like how big could this get, right? Like how many local butchers are there? You know, at what? So that's the first part. And the second part is, at what point do you say, I need help? And what does that help look like? Is it purely technical? Is it other areas, right?
Yeah, so the market for Australia, there's about 3,000 butchers, retail butchers. Then there's a whole lot of processors and about 500 abattoirs as well, from a small abattoir point of view. So we've sort of looked at going, if we can own the butcher market, it provides us a really nice stepping stone to start talking to processors. And then you step again into that small abattoir space. And we've sort of got a lot of support from the industry to do that from a traction point of view, which has been wonderful. You know, I guess for us at some point, we are working with the industry body to actually see if they want to fund this sort of development work. At which point, you know, it'll be nice to have more technical people helping build this, be able to move a little bit faster. But it is, you know, as a bootstrapped business, you can only move, I guess, as fast as your cash in the bank, right? The capital. And most of the time that is, how do we count the cents and not spend the money where we don't need to spend it?
Yeah. Well, as Carlton said, I think, you know, you sacrifice some growth, but it gives you the time to really work on what's important. And then if the growth comes later, you're all the more set up for it anyways.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, the alternative though is taking on, you know, a whole team, and then you're doing that with borrowed money or with, you know, investor money, which then gives a time limit, which then gives pressure.
Yeah, you end up with, you know, that whole really heavy pressure of, hey, we want you to get this market valuation because that's how we get our money back. And we really wanted to avoid that because as a business, we want to be a purposeful business that actually helps the industry. And we think taking that investment money just wouldn't allow us to be that mission-based business. Because ultimately, we're about how do we create safer food, you know, fundamentally. And, you know, how do we help the industry? And that's only going to work if we've got a business that is there to actually help the industry, not about how do we pay back shareholders as quick as possible. Yeah, no, it's been great just chatting about it. And I think it was a really fun exercise to actually sit there and start to dot out all the things I've actually done, because I think sometimes when you're in the business, you don't get time to reflect and go, wow, what have we've actually done quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and when you emailed us, you know, you shared, you have this demo app, which is a great way to actually play around with it and see it. And I imagine you can share a version of that with prospective customers too, where they can see, oh, this is really what it might look like. Like that's a very powerful demo to have like a you know, real life demo version.
Yeah, look, definitely in that demo experience, because again, we're taking a lot of, you know, the industry is very paper-based, so, you know, they want to touch and feel it before they commit. So that demo just lets them actually see, oh, it's not scary. It is actually easy. It's, you know, the user interface isn't overwhelming me from a user point of view. It is, I think I can make this change. And then it's kind of that support piece to get them there.
And just, again, I guess, and just one question that comes to mind is about the simplicity aspect and just, like, you're constantly focusing on that, right? Keeping it.
Yeah. So again, James, who is my contractor who works with me, he is an amazing UI, UX type person. And that's kind of his passion. So I really trust him to look at, you know, what I build and go, can we simplify this? Can we make it a more cleaner experience? You know, is a button 3 pixels too far to the left or something ridiculous like that? And he'll spot those type of things and be like, yep, let's adjust it. Let's do all that. You know, even down to like icons, consistency of icons and all that sort of stuff throughout the app. So, you know, when somebody looks at a button, they go, oh, that icon means this. Like, I don't think about that, but that's kind of what he does. And sometimes you just need that person who's got a different view on stuff to go, hey, I can build a lot of stuff, but, you know, it's not going to be pretty. I need you to take it to that next level.
Yeah. And it's good to know your limits, right? It's good to know what you're good at and what you're not.
This has been great. I mean, I really appreciate you reaching out. To be honest, we don't usually say yes when people cold email us, but we love when people do, and we can have these discussions about, again, real world projects being used with Django, and I think it definitely informs my perspective and, you know, listeners who are involved with Django development to try to be aware of this and, you know, listen to what you're saying, especially around two-factor auth, you know, these things that we can do to be a little less insular. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and share the story.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
No, thanks for coming. It's been really interesting to talk to you, Brian.
So we are at DjangoChat.com and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.